This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Pelka. At least four people have been shot dead during protests in Myanmar. The violence comes as security forces continue their crackdown against dissent following last month's military coup. Two of the victims were killed Sunday in Yangon, the country's largest city. One of them was shot in the head, and another one was shot in the abdomen, according to local media covering the demonstrations in Lang Thar Yar Township. A third person died in the northern city of Paukont when police fired into a crowd of anti-coup demonstrators. A fourth victim, a woman, died after being shot in the head in Mandalay. The independent UN human rights expert for Myanmar, Tom Andrews, said last week that credible reports indicated that at least 70 people had died so far in the protests. Other unofficial but carefully compiled tallies put the number of deaths since the coup around 90. Central African Republic voted at heavily guarded polling stations in a second round of parliamentary elections Sunday. The voting comes after rebel violence marred December's polls. Voting started smoothly with just slight delays across the capital, Bangui, according to the electoral body. Two states in Germany are voting Sunday for their new regional legislatures. Sunday's vote is 6 months ahead of general national elections, which will determine who succeeds the country's longtime chancellor, Angela Merkel. The votes in the southwestern state of Baden-Württemberg, an economic powerhouse region, and in the neighboring Rhineland-Palatinate state are seen as key for testing the national mood prior to the September 26th general elections. Read more on voanews.com. This is VOA News. London's Metropolitan Police is under heavy pressure to explain its actions during a vigil for a woman whom one of the same force's officers is accused of murdering. Hundreds defied coronavirus restrictions to gather and protest violence against women, but the event ended with clashes between police and those attending. Home Secretary Priti Patel said scenes from Saturday's vigil in South London were upsetting, and the capital's mayor, Sadiq Khan, said the police response was at times neither appropriate nor proportionate. The vigil was in memory of Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman who vanished while walking home in London. A police officer has been charged with her kidnapping and murder. Officials say the Paris, France region may be headed toward a new lockdown. This as new variants of the virus fill up intensive care units and limited vaccine supplies drag down inoculation efforts. Special medical planes dispatched patients from the Paris area to less saturated regions over the weekend. The head of the National Health Agency, Jerome Salomon, said on BFM television Sunday, quote, "The situation is complex, tense, and is worsening in the Paris region." Salomon acknowledged that a nationwide 6 p.m. curfew wasn't enough in some regions to prevent a spike in cases, notably of the variant first identified in Britain. The U.S.'s Biden administration is turning to the Federal Emergency Management Agency for help managing and caring for record numbers of unaccompanied immigrant children who are streaming into the U.S. from Mexico. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says FEMA will support a government-wide effort over the next 3 months to safely receive, shelter, and transfer minor children who arrive alone at the U.S. southwest border. Government figures show a growing crisis at the border as hundreds of children illegally enter the U.S. daily from Mexico and are taken into custody. British-Iranian charity worker Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe appeared before Iran's Revolutionary Court Sunday, facing charges of propaganda against the system. Zaghari Ratcliffe was arrested in 2016 on charges that she was plotting to overthrow Iran's government, a charge she has denied. Her lawyer said the trial was held in a calm atmosphere and the final defense was made. Zaghari Ratcliffe's lawyer added she is very hopeful her client will be acquitted. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
It feels like, you know, they're taking back all the struggle. They're taking back whatever he stood for, and they're trying to accuse him of taking the country into trouble, into violence or whatever. We feel this is wrong, and we're still waiting on the fact to see what are they accusing him for.
Civil society groups demand the release of a prominent right activist in the Congo Republic.
So it is time to come up with actions, not condemnations, but concrete actions on how to stop the conflict, giving proposals and timelines of their expectations of the government of Cameroon, because we are all part of the human race.
A civil society leader calls on the international community to pressure the Cameroonian government to protect citizens from separatists.
We've seen that there have been the first steps in the right direction in recent months, which we welcome. They are mere ad hoc gestures, and that won't be enough for lasting improvement.
And UN experts urge Burundi's president to keep the promises to improve the country's human rights record. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Republic, human rights activists and civil society groups are demanding the immediate release of prominent rights activist Dr. Alexander Ibaka Zabana. The 77-year-old Zabana, who is the coordinator of the Congolese platform of human rights NGOs, was arrested by plainclothes security operatives Thursday. He is accused of plotting with others outside the country to destabilize the upcoming presidential election. But critics say this arrest is a tactic the administration is deploying to silence dissent and intimidate opponents before the vote. Supporters of the administration say human rights activists and NGOs support the opposition and in some instances are campaigning for them in the run-up to the election, an accusation they deny. Joe Washington is the president of Ibina Foundation, a human rights group in Congo Republic's capital, Brazzaville. He tells me that civil society and human rights defenders are concerned about the health of Mr. Zabana, but also ask that they will continue pressing for the government to respect the right of all citizens.
We're really concerned right now, and we're really asking for his release. There's just no reason to his arrest. We still want to find out why was he arrested for. We still don't know really what's going on. But we're very concerned, and we hope that he was going to be released very soon.
Officials of the government are denying that he has been kidnapped. So why are you saying he was kidnapped?
He was taken away from the street. There was no legal procedure of the way he was taken away. So we call that to be kidnapped, because nobody knew about what he was about. And he was walking on the street, and then all of a sudden about five guys took him away in a private car. That is not the normal procedure. And the government usually come up to stories. They just deny everything. There's some violation in this country. Let me remind you that he's 77 years old. So it's an old man, and that's not a way to treat people, seriously.
There are local reports that are suggesting that he was arrested because he was in contact with Congolese officers from outside who are planning to destabilize the upcoming elections. What do you say to that?
Well, I cannot confirm those allegations. We haven't heard such stories. I mean, we heard them saying that. But for me, for us, it's just not based on any facts, really.
But supporters of the government are of the view that civil society groups or NGOs like yours are running campaigns or tarnishing the reputation of the president, and by extension, trying to say the elections will not be free or fair. So don't you think that sometimes your activities tend to ruffle some feathers?
We must look at it this way. This country is in a mess in a lot of fields. The civil society comes up, and usually we're very concerned about the way people live in this country. We're concerned about education. We're concerned about the health system. We're concerned about corruption. Now, when we mention those things that are totally corrupting the country, they're totally killing the people in the sense where people are surviving in this country, the government's just not happy about us saying that. They want us not to complain on anything. They want us to stand by them and confirm that whatever they're doing is the right way of going. We feel that it's wrong. There's some values in this country that need to be respected. The law needs to be respected. And we will stand by that, regardless of whatever they feel, whatever the government says. They usually feel that we're backing up the opposition parties. But this is not a fact. We standing by the people and for the people. And somebody must stand for them. When we come to the Congo, where the resources, the natural resources, are such a lot in this country, and people are struggling so much, we need to say no to that. And if we feel the elections are not fair, if we feel that things are not really settled the way it should be, equality and everything, we will complain and we will definitely mention what we feel on everyday basis, that when things are not fair, they're not fair.
Well, indeed, there have been accusations that you back the opposition against the government, but your demand for Mr. Ibaka to be presented to court so the legal process will take its course, some people are saying they don't see that happening. What is your take on that?
You got to remember that in the Congo, the civil society before the election about 5 years ago, we requested to have a dialogue, an inclusive dialogue, to have all the Congolese to go on a dialogue and make clear, to settle the election, to settle the way the country is run, to get the prisoners out of jail, Mokoko and Okombi out of jail. Because we felt that nothing can be fair in this election. There's no transparency in this election if the people that are in jail are not be freed. Now, let's come back to Dr. Ibaka. Well, you got to understand, this man being in the struggle for about 50 years, over 50, 60 years, he stood against the system for a long time. This is an old-timer, man. This is a man who stood for the people for a long time. And I feel that with whatever is happening right now, it feels like, you know, they're taking back all this struggle. They're taking back whatever he stood for. And they're trying to accuse him of taking the country into trouble, into violence or whatever. We feel this is wrong. And we're still waiting on the fact to see what are they accusing him for.
Joe Washington is the president of Ibina Foundation, a human rights group in the Congo Republic. He spoke with me from the capital, Brazzaville. In Cameroon, the leader of the Northwest and Southwest Women's Task Force is calling on the international community to help the country protect its citizens. Sally Mbomian says the administration in Yaoundé has been ineffective in protecting citizens, mainly in the Anglophone regions that are caught up in the ongoing conflict. Her remarks follow reports that separatists have increased kidnappings and in some cases demand ransom. Local media reports school children, women, civil servants, business people, and the clergy have been victims of the recent surge in abductions. Analysts say the phenomenon is enabling the separatists to purchase weapons and other supplies, thereby prolonging the violence. Sally Mbomian tells me that the international community can play a major role, including putting pressure on the warring parties to end the conflict.
This report is a confirmation of various allegations that have been coming from the population, women, men, children, that they are being kidnapped by the separatists to give ransom for them to foil their activities within the regions. Many families have been hit. There have always been people complaining that separatists actually kidnapped them, and confronting separatist leaders, they would defend it by saying they are the fake boys or they are not actually fighters. But as activists, we look at it and think that the best thing that should happen is there is no protection for the citizen, because this act of kidnaps, it is very rampant, especially among school children, that they are coming back from school, you get them, they feel they are kidnapped. We have people who work in different offices. If they look that you're financially viable, you can give some money, you are kidnapped. So at this juncture, we know that kidnapping is at the height. It's increasing in the regions, and people's security and protection is not guaranteed.
Sally, some people are saying that if this trend of kidnapping for ransom
to support their activities, then the conflict in Cameroon will not end anytime soon. Do you share that sentiment?
That is why I am making a clarion call to the international community, to the government of Cameroon, separatist leaders themselves, to understand that kidnapping is a violation of human rights, and the effects of it in this conflict-affected region is hatred, bitterness, and the desire to avenge or revenge, which will never see an end. So where we are right now at the conflict, the best thing to do is to address this conflict, because apparently all the solutions or the actions that have been taken by parties to this conflict, be it the government of Cameroon, international actors, it is yet to heal fruits on the conflict, and we are prescribing a peace negotiation.
So what do you think the government and by extension the international community can do in this regard to help end the spate of kidnappings that some suggest separatists are using to fund their activities?
The government of Cameroon, from all its policies and interventions, have always projected the population as their primary interest, protecting them and ensuring their well-being as their primary interest. And given the fact that we are very certain and convinced that this act of kidnapping for ransom has become the face of the conflict in the Northwest and Southwest, with alleged perpetrators being the separatist fighter, we will call on the government, for the sake of its population, to go into a negotiation with the purported leaders of the separatist movement, because it is alleged that they are responsible for these kidnappings. For the sake of the population they have set out to protect in all their manifestos and public discourses and whatever decisions they've been making. This is a better way to safeguard a people and prevent this conflict from transforming into a deadly conflict that can extend to the other 8 regions of the country. Because these kidnappings know no bound. They don't kidnap only people of the English-speaking regions. People of the other 8 regions are also kidnapped when they find themselves in the Northwest and Southwest region as a geographical space. So we will call on the government to step up its game, to be able to protect its population by moving towards talking with the separatist leaders. Because this act is an act for the population, for whom the government has done all its policies and governance and telling us that they are working for the well-being of the population. For the kidnappings to end, I don't think there is any international body that has to stay quiet, because kidnapping is a gross human rights violation. We call on international bodies to rise above making strong statements to condemn those actions, into taking critical actions to support the government of Cameroon better protect its citizens. There should be actions we call to actions and directions with timelines of expectation from the government of Cameroon and separatist leaders to talk about the protection of its population. Yes, dividing Cameroon or staying united, it can be an internal affair, but the international community agrees that human race is unique, irrespective of the geopolitical boundaries that we have set. But the truth is, human race is unique, and they cannot fold their arms and watch people of the Northwest and Southwest pay a huge price. So it is time to come up with actions, not condemnations, but concrete actions on how to stop the conflict, giving proposals and timelines of their expectations of the government of Cameroon, because we are all part of the human race.
Sally Mbomien is the leader of the Northwest and Southwest Women's Task Force. She spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Islamic State-linked groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique are the newest entries on the United States list of foreign terrorist groups. This week, U.S. officials talked about how these groups started and why they deserve this designation. Anita Powell files from Johannesburg.
There is a specter haunting Africa, specter of terrorism. So say top American counterterrorism officials, who say they're doing everything they can to exercise this violent threat, which directly impacts the safety and stability of U.S. partner nations like the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique. This week, the State Department drew a line in the sand by designating two African groups, the Islamic State affiliate in Congo and the branch in Mozambique, as foreign terrorist organizations. The group in eastern Congo has been responsible for a series of attacks that killed at least 849 civilians last year, according to United Nations reports. Mozambican group is responsible for thousands of civilian deaths through a series of large-scale attacks in the country's north that has displaced nearly 670,000 people. A designation is more than just a label, says John Godfrey, acting coordinator for counterterrorism and acting special envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat the Islamic State. He spoke to journalists Thursday via teleconference from Washington.
Among other consequences of those designations, any property or interests in property of those designated and subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions with them. It is a crime to knowingly provide material support or resources to ISIS in the Democratic Republic of the Congo or to ISIS in Mozambique, or to attempt or conspire to do so. Designations are one of the most important tools we have to disrupt the financial and other support networks that terrorist groups need to export violence and carry out attacks.
Godfrey declined to say why American officials are so sure that these African groups are tied to the Islamic State, saying the information is classified. But he said the evidence of ties between the IS in Mozambique and the main IS core in Iraq and Syria is quite incontrovertible. And in Congo, he said the U.S. is quite confident of a link to Islamic State headquarters. Michael Gonzalez, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of African Affairs, said the U.S. fights terrorism in a variety of ways and described how they do so in Congo.
We do support the FARDC in terms of their efforts against violent extremists, with particularly four lines of effort, bolstering civil military operations and capabilities, military engineering, strategic communications, and English language laboratories, with the goal of empowering civilian leadership to promote structural reform and professionalization of the military. I think these are prime examples of how the United States is really running with the vision of the Biden administration and the statements of Secretary Blinken about emphasizing our partnerships with African partners and building local capacity, because it's through that local capacity that there will be sustainable gains that are able to be realized through the future.
So how long will it take to vanquish these two new groups, which only started to show their mettle in the past 3 years? That officials did not say. Some groups on the U.S. list of terror organizations, like Al-Qaeda, have stayed there since the late 1990s, meaning they remain active more than 20 years after the U.S. deemed them a threat. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
UN experts are urging Burundi's president to keep the promises he made when he assumed power in June to improve the country's human rights record. The UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi has submitted a report to the UN Human Rights Council on the prevailing situation in the country. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The verdict is still out on whether President Evariste Ndayishimiye will become a champion of human rights or continue the repressive policies of his predecessor Pierre Nkurunziza. The UN Commission says the situation remains ambiguous. President of the three-member commission, Dudu Dien, says since Ndayishimiye assumed power, he has been promising to promote the rule of law, make the judicial system more impartial, and strengthen reconciliation in the country. He speaks through an interpreter.
We've seen that there have been the first steps in the right direction in recent months, which we welcome. They are mere ad hoc gestures, and that won't be enough for a lasting improvement. But we would like to say that whilst there have been signs of improvement, there are also reasons for concern.
Dien says the commission recommends several concrete actions, which, if they are followed, would decisively advance human rights. First and foremost, he says, is to stop human rights violations and fight impunity. He speaks through an interpreter.
The first positive sign is that the government has shown that it has the resources, when it wishes, to control the Imbonerakure, by holding some of them accountable for serious crimes and by allowing them to be brought to justice and punished, notably for the murders of political opponents. That's encouraging.
Unfortunately, he says, grave violations of human rights continue to be committed, and the Imbonerakure, the youth wing of the ruling party, continues to usurp the role of the police and army in rural areas and commit criminal acts with impunity. The commission also calls on the government to guarantee the safety of journalists and freedom of the media. It says the government must create an environment in which human rights defenders and political opponents can operate in safety and without fear of being arbitrarily arrested or forcibly disappeared. Burundi's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Zachary Gahutu, says he regrets that certain ill-intentioned stakeholders are seeking to tarnish Burundi's image at a time when major efforts are being made to stabilize the country. He calls on the council not to undermine the government's efforts and let it get on with the job of making progress. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Amnesty International is criticizing Zimbabwe's plan to evict 12,000 members of the Shangani indigenous minority from ancestral land, despite a court order halting it. Zimbabwe's government this week indicated the evictions to make way for animal feed production will go ahead despite the order. For VOA, Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Amnesty International says Zimbabwe should stop the planned evictions of the Shangani people who live in Chiredzi district, Chilonga village, on the border with Mozambique. Robert Chibambu is the rights group's spokesman for Southern Africa.
Zimbabwean authorities are attempting to remove Chilonga people from their ancestral homes to make way for commercial interests without offering them any alternative accommodation. The affected people are anxious and have nowhere to go. Forced evictions drive people into poverty and destroy livelihoods. Zimbabwean authorities have a grim history of not observing due processes when evicting people, including failing to consult affected communities or offering alternative place of accommodation when carrying out evictions.
The Chilonga villagers are being evicted to make way for grass production to make animal feed for a dairy company. Jobless 44-year-old Livison Chikutu is one of 12,000 Shanghanis set to be evicted, along with his wife and four children. Speaking from Chiredzi via a messaging application, he says an eviction would leave them homeless.
The government is against the people. They are doing so because we are a minority tribe. This area of ours is very rich, especially in terms of the soil. It is the black soil. So the government just wants to shift us in other ways. They are saying, go back to Mozambique, where historically is where we are said to be coming from.
Chikutu and Amnesty International say authorities are harassing the indigenous minorities despite a March 6 court order that suspended the planned eviction. Ezra Chazamira is President Emmerson Mnangagwa's representative in the area under which Chiredzi falls. He refused to comment on the allegations, but defended the planned evictions this week to journalists. He says production of alfalfa in Chiredzi is a welcome development as people there raise cattle and goats. They'll get feed for their animals, says Chazamira, and they will also become employed. He says some people will become alfalfa growers. We are not evicting them, insists Chazamira. We are just realigning settlements so there's land for alfalfa production and animal grazing. He says that's a development initiative that will lift people up. Not everyone agrees with the government's positive spin on the project. The issue dominated debate in Zimbabwe's parliament this week. Independent lawmaker Themba Muliswa voiced opposition to evicting the Shangani people.
They've been there for a very long time. many years. There are 12,000. Not only that, but plus those who live off them, it could be 50,000. Over one person. Have we now gotten to a point of reversing the land reform? What is the cost of 12,000 people vis-a-vis one farmer? The government has enough farms to be able to give, identify, give to him. But we cannot afford to reverse the land reform, the gains of the struggle. What are the people of Zimbabwe going to be left with?
Zimbabwe's government said it would address the concerns about the evictions in due course without giving a specific time frame. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
It's the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, Sudan this week launched its COVID-19 vaccination campaign with priority giving to the elderly and healthcare workers. Sudan has lost scores of healthcare workers to the virus, and hopes are high that the vaccine will better protect doctors and nurses on the front lines. For VOA, Naba Muhyiddin reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Sudan launched its COVID-19 vaccination campaign on Tuesday after receiving its first shipment of the AstraZeneca vaccine earlier this month. Officials are giving priority to the elderly and the healthcare workers, most of whom have been working without adequate personal protective equipment since the pandemic began a year ago. This is Dali Idris, a member of Sudanese Higher Committee of Defeating Coronavirus. She says the COVAX initiative will provide Sudan with enough vaccine to cover 20% of the population. At their completion to receive the vaccine, the priority is for frontline workers in all Sudanese states, including isolation centers, pharmacies, hospitals and primary health care centers in all public, private and military sectors, without any exceptions. At least 60 healthcare workers have died since the second wave of COVID-19 hit Sudan in December. But some healthcare professionals feel optimistic with the start of vaccination. Dr. Hanana Muhammad has been treating COVID patients in Sudanese hospitals. She says all of the frontline doctors, nurses and workers are in danger for getting infected with COVID-19. She says the beginning of the vaccination is a very big step to defeat coronavirus. Dr. Abir Osman thinks the vaccine will give healthcare workers a much-needed lift. She says the vaccination is encouraging to the frontline workers after suffering for a long time with the coronavirus. The vaccine will motivate healthcare workers to defeat the third wave that we have indications of, such as the increasing number of cases. The Sudanese Ministry of Health warned of a so-called third wave this week, noting an increase in respiratory diseases and suspected cases of COVID-19. Sudan has registered nearly 29,000 cases of coronavirus since the beginning of the pandemic last year, with just over 1,900 deaths. Sudan received an initial 820,000 vaccine doses last year. The country will eventually receive 3.9 million doses, provided by the COVAX program that distributes vaccines to developing countries. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The Malawian National Assembly has rejected a motion to debate liberalizing the country's strict law against abortion, which is only allowed if the mother's life is at risk. Despite thousands of Malawian women dying each year from unsafe abortions, lawmakers on Thursday refused to debate the matter. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
Malawi's National Assembly has rejected a motion to debate liberalizing the country's strict law against abortion, which is only allowed if the mother's life is at risk. Despite thousands of Malawian women dying each year from unsafe abortions, lawmakers on Thursday refused to debate the matter. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre. Malawi lawmakers unanimously rejected a motion to debate the long-delayed termination of pregnancy bill. The bill, pushed by activists since 2015, aimed to expand legal abortions from cases where the mother's life is at risk to include rape, incest, fetal deformity, and threats to health. The debate on Thursday, though, never even started. Richard Chimwendo Banda is the leader of the House in Malawi's National Assembly.
What they have done today is to deny even discussing it, which means you can't force members. They don't want it. They don't even want to discuss about it. And there was no one, actually. There was no single yes. So out of all the members who were in Parliament, all of them refused.
A group of about 50 female activists demonstrated outside Malawi's Parliament Thursday in support of the bill before the debate was rejected. Gender activist Titani Magalasi was among them. She says they are not giving up.
Just because it was not tabled this week, actually that doesn't mean that it's been defeated, because it never actually came onto the table, meaning that we can even push for next week, as private members' bills are always tabled on Thursdays. So next week, Thursday, be sure to see us back there in our numbers fighting for the same bill to be tabled.
However, Banda said that, judging from Thursday's reaction, he doubts lawmakers will debate the bill during the current sitting of Parliament, which ends March 26. The current 160-year-old law criminalizes abortion unless the mother's life is in danger, with offenders facing up to 14 years in jail. Critics say the law leads to more than 140,000 backstreet abortions annually that cause 12,000 deaths, according to a joint study by Malawi's College of Medicine and the US-based Gatmacha Institute. Countless other Malawian women are left permanently scarred. Jesse Chingoma is a board member of the Gender Coordination Network, which has been pushing for changing the law.
It's unfortunate that we continuing delaying the process. If status quo continues, it means the women and girls will continue having unsafe abortion, which is also a violation of their rights.
The bill was to be debated last year, but was dropped because of widespread opposition from conservative and religious groups who consider all abortions to be murder. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Dr. Patrice Masepe was elected CAF president on Friday in the Moroccan capital, Rabat. Masepe becomes the seventh person to occupy the position of CAF president. He begins his four-year term after being elected and opposed by the member associations of CAF at their 43rd General Assembly. The 59-year-old Masepe is an accomplished South African businessman and philanthropist. He has been the president of a South African club, Mamelodi Sundowns, for almost 20 years. And former FIFA employee Veron Masengo Omba has been appointed the new General Secretary of CAF. The Swiss Congolese replaces Morocco's Abdel Bar, who had occupied the role in an acting capacity since March of 2020. According to FIFA, Masengo Omba has left his role at FIFA, where he had recently been working as Chief Member Associations Officer. Meanwhile, CAF will now allow several countries to host their African Cup of Nations qualifiers on home soil. Sierra Leone, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Burundi can now play Nations Cup ties at home later this month. However, the decision from CAF is only a temporary lifting of the ban because of the current travel restrictions being implemented around the world due to the COVID-19 pandemic. CAF had asked the four countries to move their final home matches in the qualifiers to neutral venues after it had ruled that their stadia did not meet the required standards to host international matches. Sierra Leone had already secured a venue in Conakry, the capital of Guinea, to host their Group L tie against Benin, but the match will be brought back to Freetown. And Burkina Faso will host their Group B encounter with South Sudan in Ouagadougou. Burundi, who had been in talks with Morocco to host their tie against the Central African Republic in Casablanca, will now be able to play in Bujumbura in Group E. Niger, meanwhile, will play Ivory Coast on March 26th in Niamey. The International Olympic Committee, IOC President Thomas Bach, has announced that the Chinese Olympic Committee has offered the COVID vaccine doses for those competing at the Summer Games and the 2022 Winter Games in Beijing.
Bach also reiterated that the delayed Tokyo 2020 Games will start on July 23rd, adding that the IOC will pay for additional doses of vaccines for the Olympic and Paralympic team. And on a sad note in boxing, boxing legend, former undisputed middleweight world champion, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, has died at the age of 66. The American dominated the middleweight division from 1979 until his controversial defeat by Sugar Ray Leonard in April of 1987. Hagler took part in 67 fights during his 14-year professional career. He won 62 of those, 52 by knockout, while he drew twice and lost three times. Hagler made 12 successful title defenses and famously won the classic fight known as the War when he beat Thomas Hitman Hans in April 1985. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I'm not afraid to die.
was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the strength of the crocodile is the water. I'm your host, Peter Clonte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.